Thank you very much. Our next case this morning is A24-0918 in the matter of the welfare of the child of DLP and JAP. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. It's my understanding the respondents will be splitting their time. I was wondering if, counsel, you could tell us again how much and who'll be starting first.
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. This is Angela Sonsala, the Guardian Ad Litem Program. There are three respondents in this case. It's my understanding that the county and Mr. Haugen, on behalf of the county, have not asked for or are not asking for any time. So the split would be 10 minutes for the Guardian Ad Litem and then 5 minutes for the foster parents who are represented by Sarah Clausen.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Then, counsel for the appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. You can hear me okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. May it please the court. My name is Rhea Borman Spears, and I am here on behalf of the appellant, Thomas Renstrom, who's also present this morning via Zoom. The considerations this morning have to do with the district court's determination of whether or not Mr. Renstrom made a prima facie case. And of course, this court gets to review that de novo. And I'll be asking, as I did in the brief, for the court to also take a dive into reasonable, which I have been before this court before complaining that we need more clarity on interpretation for the district courts about reasonable. Specifically, should the district courts be relying on Black Law Dictionary's definition of reasonable as they've been doing? Should they be relying on the compilation of the statutes as is argued in MLS? And should they be focusing on case law's interpretation as is in MLS? Both the unpublished MLS as well as the published MLS decision that we cited in our brief. I would like
to point out. Counsel, it's Judge Larkin. Could you tell us how you think we should define reasonableness in the context of the statute dealing with a relative's request for pre-adaptive placement? How are we to measure that if it's not the Black's Law definition?
Well, I put a lot of emphasis in the brief on MLS, and I believe MLS provides us with a definition, and MLS specifically outlined situation, you know, the situational factors of that case.
Which MLS are you talking about, the published decision or the unpublished decision? Because there were different issues in the two cases.
You're exactly right. And the one that was the unpublished had the same issue we have, which is that she was arguing for an evidentiary hearing. And then the one that was published ended up saying that there should be that preferential treatment or relatives, which we believe also goes back again to the unreasonableness factor, that if there should be this preference for relatives, the agency is unreasonable if they don't do the things cited in the unpublished MLS, specifically repeatedly, if a party has repeatedly expressed desire to be placement early on, the relative, and documenting that the agency has been unresponsive to them, and that they've obtained a home study from on their own, you know, recognizance, because again, the agency didn't assist with that, and that they're able to meet the best interest factors. So if we have all of those situational facts, which we do in our fact pattern, then I believe that that should help us know that MLS was defining unreasonable as such. You know, that the agency was unreasonable if those four things are present. I also think it goes further, this court has gone further, but again, it's another unpublished decision, which I cited on page 27 of my brief. And in that case, there are six factors that were written out. Specifically, the county was unreasonable in failing to exercise due diligence in a relative search, and thereby failing to timely find appropriate relative placement resources. Number two, the county was unreasonable in failing to consider relative placement first. Number three, county was unreasonable in failing to timely refer someone to a home study, which again, they didn't do that for our client, my client. And then number four, the county was unreasonable in failing to timely move the child to that relative's care once the ICPC was approved and received, or in our fact pattern, once the license for foster care was received. And then number five, the county was unreasonable in failing to timely consider the best interest factors regarding child's placement. Another fact we have in this case, their consideration of the best.
We only need to find a prima facie case of one ground of unreasonableness, right? Do we have to find multiple? And we don't need to, do we need to find that the county was in fact unreasonable here? I mean, we're not, all we're determining is whether or not the district court erred in failing to find a prima facie case on at least one ground of unreasonableness, right?
You're exactly right, Your Honor. What I'm pointing out is that the district court judge had all of these resources available to him to consider any of these different factors when he was determining reasonableness or not in my client's prima facie argument. And I would agree with you that obviously he made multiple of these. So if there was one, he made enough. I mean, the fact that they never went out and saw his home before evaluating the best interest factors. I mean, to this day, the agency, you know, never saw his home. So,
counsel, I think your brief indicates that they never met with your client. Did they have a meeting with him to discuss placement, or did the county ever, or was county only in the room with them during supervised visitation, if even then?
So I don't know if the court noticed that the best interest factors were apparently evaluated in a letter that resulted. It's referred to in all the different briefs. And that letter was done almost a year prior to the time we argued this motion. And that letter, by the point it was done, the agency had never met my client. And since then, they have only met him in the process of observing a supervised visit. And during that process, it was not an interview. It was not a get to know you. It was a, I'm quietly in the corner observing, maybe a little chit chat, taking notes.
Okay. Counsel, so what you're telling the court is that the only time the county's representative met with your client was to sit silently in the back of a room during a supervised visitation. So they never had a conversation with him about placement?
That's right. And the phone calls were almost always unreturned or minimal. And the agency worker even made false reports to the court, such as that my client had not asked about the well-being of the child, when those inquiries were all made via email.
Can I ask you a question? At any point in the proceeding, and I know this proceeding has been up to us a few times, but did the district court make a finding under 260C.221 subdivision 5B that the parents' request that the child not be placed with your client was consistent with the best interests of the child?
That's a fantastic question and point. And no, because the best interest factors don't consider what a terminated parent wants. And also, the terminated parent didn't want the child placed with the foster parents either. So the agency, of course, is being unreasonable in that consideration, that it only matters that she doesn't want him placed with her brother, but it doesn't matter that she doesn't want them with this particular foster family. Specifically, of course, one of her biggest complaints was that they had renamed him and were taking away his identity. I also want to point out that the court order, the findings for this are so limited. It's only 8 through 12. And number 12 is a conclusory statement saying no prima facie case established. And number 8, 9, 10, and 11 are telling us what CCFS did, not talking about what my client proved in his affidavit. And we specifically pointed out that the court's own words can be used against it, because the court said, based on the reasons set forth by CCFS, which is not the legal standard.
Counsel, Judge Larkin again, I wonder if on this issue of reasonableness, we find any direction in 260C.607 subdivision 5B, which is the subdivision before the one that's being applied here. And that provides any relative who believes the responsible agency has not reasonably considered the relative's request to be considered for adoption, and who wants to be considered for adoption, shall bring a request for consideration, on and on. That to me is of some interest, because at least that seems to suggest that when we're considering reasonableness in the context of pre-adoptive placement, you know, perhaps the focus needs to be on, you know, what the agency did. Did the agency do enough? And so I guess what your argument is here, the agency didn't do enough because it never met with your client, never visited your client's home, was making statements along the way that, don't worry, you're our placement to the foster parents, even though he's involved. So you're essentially just saying the law is clear that the relative has to get some preference. I think it's, you'll have to agree that if you do get to the point of a hearing, you know, you then consider both sides and weigh the benefits, pros and cons of each placement. But at this stage, we should look at, well, did the agency really satisfy its obligation to explore this relative placement? If not, the agency was unreasonable, at least enough to get you to an evidentiary hearing to further explore that, and to then explore the pros and cons of each placement.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I would.
What
also
about the?
Do you argue
that the district court, as I read the district court's order, you know, the district court does reference the allegations of sister, seemingly as a basis to say, well, the agency wasn't unreasonable. But can the district court do that if it's supposed to accept your client's allegations as true?
I would argue they can't, and that would be exactly my point about those findings, is the findings say CCFS considered this letter, CCFS considered this prior rule-out, which I would point out all, you know, both the all three briefs, the foster parent, the guardian, the agency, focused on the fact that Mr. Renstrom was supposedly ruled out by the prior court in the prior case.
But
not
we don't have an order
irrelevant.
Ruling him out, right? And we have case law that
right.
says there has to be an order.
Exactly, Your Honor. And it would be irrelevant if it had happened because of the fact that this is a new case and he did end up being considered and involved. But it also matters because it wasn't done properly, just as you said. And so that, again, the district court findings rely on that, which is another error for the district court judge to not recognize that that doesn't matter and that wasn't a proper rule out.
Was there a motion to stay the court's order terminating visitation pending the appeal? In other words, has your client had any visitation between May 22nd and now?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know how much I'm allowed to speak about what's happening post this process, but yes, the agency has asked to reinstate visitation and has asked to potentially, well, not potentially, they've asked to place the child with my client ultimately.
Oh, okay.
However,
hold the phone. The agency yes. has asked to reinstate visitation and is considering placement with your client.
Yes, but this issue isn't moot yet because the foster parent and guardian
Understood.
Are now arguing that there should be an evidentiary hearing. Which of course is ironic that they're arguing there should be an evidentiary hearing about the agency wanting to place with my client. And yet they're arguing that there shouldn't be an evidentiary hearing when my client was looking for placement. So hopefully that answers your question and is okay that I guess I shared that information. To close, since I'm almost out of time, I wanted to point out that the best interest factors, that we have no disagreement that my client can meet the best interest factors. And so we did want to refer, I did want to make that point that the court had relied on SG And in the transcript, of course, you can see too that the judge gave an opportunity for me to talk about why SG didn't matter for this case, and that MLS does provide clarification about SG, and that there is supposed to be that preference when the best interest factors can be met by both. And I do think that it would be very helpful if this court would talk about that. Of course, I would love it if this, you know, was a precedential decision in our favor, but just that we do seem to have a repeat issue of district courts, you know, not focusing on the fact that we have had MLS say there is supposed to be that preference. And I wanted to point out too, that we have identified in our, or that my client did identify in his affidavit, specific examples. And of course, Judge Larkin, you pointed out that he brought up that the agency hadn't met with him, but he also brought up all the additional points that match with the four unreasonable sites from MLS Unpublished, of the ignoring him, and that he obtained the home study and he met the best interest factors. And I see my time is done. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel from the respondents. Ms. Sinsala, are you going to go first then?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, I will go first.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. I'm Angela Sinsala, and I'm here representing the guardian ad litem today. Obviously, the court is...
Ms. Sinsala, I'm going to stop you for a minute. I mean, unless I'm wrong, you have... I always get the time messed up. Ms. Sinsala, you have 5 minutes or 10 minutes?
Oh, I have 10 minutes and I see it just started at five.
Yes. If you could, if I would ask the marshal to recalibrate that.
If Judge Connolly?
Yes.
Just because now I'm confused.
You have
seen something? I'm looking at the letter from Ms. Sinsala, which notifies us that respondent guardian ad litem will have 5 minutes. Respondent foster parents will have 10 minutes.
Yes, I agree. So maybe we can just, Ms. Clausen, do you have 10 minutes or 5 minutes?
Your Honor, I would, 5 minutes would be acceptable for me.
Okay, so we're now going to change it. So then Ms. Clausen, as counsel for the foster parents, you'll have 5 minutes and then the guardian ad litem will have 10 minutes. Am I right then?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I did that. The first letter that I filed inadvertently flipped the time. I did file a second letter that stated the 10 minutes and 5 minutes. So my apologies for that confusion.
All right. Then Ms. Sinsala, if I would ask the marshal, yes, it's been stated at 10 minutes. So then Ms. Sinsala, why don't you start over again, please? Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, counsel. May it please the court. I'm Angela Sinsala and I'm here representing the guardian ad litem today. The court is clearly, excuse me, aware of what the issues here are today.
What is the focus of the reasonableness determination in this context, or what should it be? Should we be looking at whether the agency failed to meet its obligations under law? Should we be looking at whether concerns regarding the agency's chosen pre-adoptive placement have been raised such that it's unreasonable not to look elsewhere? I mean, what does reasonableness mean?
Your Honor, I believe reasonableness, clearly it's open to interpretation as it's not been clearly defined by law.
If we're considering, did a district court abuse its discretion or did an agency act unreasonably? One thing we also often look at is, did the deciding authority comply with the law or misapply the law? And it seems here there is an argument that the county did not comply with the law because it did not make, you know, adequate efforts to explore this relative placement who indicated ready, willing, able to accept the child and had a home study and a foster care license. Is that the sort of unreasonable conduct that could justify a finding that the agency's pre-adoptive placement determination was unreasonable?
I believe that reasonableness in this case was ultimately determined by the district court in its order when it talked about the Black's law definition of reasonableness.
Okay, I know that, but did you understand the question I asked you? For the purpose of the pre-adoptive placement statute, does the county act unreasonably in denying a relative placement if it neglects to comply with statutory and case law requirements regarding relative preferences?
I think it does. I would agree with Your Honor that it does, but that's one piece of the totality of
well,
what
if it okay. does, then how do you not lose?
I think that in this case, the court did, comes down to the affidavits and the supporting documents that were filed by appellant in this case to support his original motion. I don't believe that his originally filed documents and supporting documents rose to the level of meeting that burden for to make a prima facie showing. And I think
Why not?
Because it lacks detail, and it specifically lacks individualized.
But does he not say, you know, they've never called me, they've never visited my home. They were surprised to learn my partner's a chef when she brought baby food to the visit, which indicates they really had never read our home study. I mean, there are specific examples or allegations of the county just sort of ignoring appellant, despite appellant's, you know, efforts to be considered as a placement.
I think that it's that appellant, he does make some of those allegations. The allegations, however, the court determined didn't rise to that level of unreasonableness because I don't think that they were specific enough. The allegation about, for example, the appellant being a chef and being able to puree okay. baby
Is
food.
There any dispute that the county sole meeting with appellant was being present at one supervised visit?
There is dispute regarding that, Your Honor. I believe that the county was present at multiple visits and engaged. The way that it's presented by by appellant's attorney makes it sound like the county was sitting on the sidelines and not doing anything, but the county was in fact at the
Did
visit.
The county, is there any dispute regarding the allegation that the county never visited his home to see where he lived?
I don't believe that that's disputed, Your Honor. But I would say that appellant's attorney even today said that the phone calls were almost always unreturned. That indicates that the phone calls by the county to the appellant were in fact returned sometimes. And so again, that goes to a question of reasonableness. How often, how many phone calls do there have to be? Does the county have to return every single phone call that anybody makes to them? And I think that reasonableness is determined by the fact finder. I think the district court took into consideration all of what the county had done and what the county, well, I shouldn't say all of, but took into consideration the allegations and also the county's submission and the guardian ad litem submission, which really just go to clarify the allegations made by the appellant.
And Sincella, you know, in reviewing the district court's order, it did seem to me, again, I can only speak for myself, that the court seemed to be putting a great deal of weight to mother's allegations of abuse by Ms. Spears' clients. I mean, would that be a fair statement?
Partially, if I may explain.
Okay.
I think that the court did put
it did, even though that's never been proven. Is that a fair statement?
No. I don't think it's a fair statement. I think that just
so he has been convicted of sexual abuse?
No.
Okay. Well, okay, go ahead. I'll let you know.
If I may just explain, I think that Your Honor stated that the court make essentially significant or put a significant weight on mother's statements and the sexual abuse. And I don't think that it was by any means the most significant or even a significant factor. I think it is one that may appear that way in the order because it is discussed, but I think it's important to note that the reason I think that the court went into so much discussion about that particular issue is because the appellant's moving documents go into much discussion about that particular issue.
But isn't the district court, when making the decision at the prima facie stage, required to accept appellant's allegations or affidavit as true? So the district court is required to accept that he did not abuse mother as described. And if that's the case, I mean, I can see this area is tricky because the district court has to assume his allegations are true that he did not abuse mother. But at the same time, I think the district court has to look at, well, what was the county thinking when they did this? And the county was thinking, well, we've got these allegations there, and the county's not required to reject them as untruthful. So it does get difficult. I'll give you that. One thing that concerns me is, you know, did the district court, in reaching this conclusion that the county acted unreasonably, sort of compare, oh, well, how would the placement be with the uncle versus how would the placement be with the foster parents, and kind of compare the two placements?
Thank you, Your Honor. And just, I would agree with Your Honor when you state that the court has to take the allegations as true. But I do not believe that the court weighed the foster parents against appellant. I don't think that the court order denying the motion and denying an evidentiary hearing gets into really weighing between the two.
The memorandum, the third paragraph right before the end, says the Renstroms argue that CCFS was unreasonable considering the fact the child would not be able to have contact with the sisters if he was adopted by the foster family and not to have contact with sisters if adopted by the Renstroms. And then the court seems to spend some time saying why that's what would happen. It's basically essentially saying, you know, the child's siblings are still going to be siblings. So this was essentially seeming to justify why it's okay for the district court to have considered that. I'm having trouble understanding your argument there, because the way the district court's memorandum reads is that the district court was in fact crediting this consideration of a post-adoptive contact between the siblings and why that would be preferable if the child was placed with a foster family.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And I don't dispute that there was some discussion of that issue in the district court's order. And I think that discussion, again, was because looking at what the appellant put in this, in his moving documents and the supporting documents, it was about his concerns about the foster parents. It was about his concerns about the allegations by the mother of sexual assault against him. Those were the primary things and I think the district court's order makes it clear that that's what appellant was focusing on. So I don't know how the court would not address those particular things, at least broadly, when issuing its order. And I think that goes to the greater point that appellant's affidavit and supporting documents did not contain significant. I see my time is up. May I just
please answer the question? Yes,
I do not believe that appellant's moving documents contained those individualized and observed examples of how or why the county was unreasonable. And I think that that's lacking. And because that's lacking, the district court correctly determined that appellant did not make a prima facie showing in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Sancela. Ms. Clausen, you'll have 5 minutes, ma'am.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Sarah Clausen. I appear on behalf of the foster parents in these proceedings. And I want to start out by pointing out that this is the third appeal on this case. Twice the case was appealed by the biological parents relating to the termination of parental rights. And at this point now, this child has been in placement for 870 days with the foster parents. And yet the child's placement remains in jeopardy. The court
counsel, I just have to say in response to that, if the district court here would have simply held an evidentiary hearing at which it would have been well within its right and required to comparatively weigh the best interests of such placement, we wouldn't have this extra delay. So, you know, arguments about we've had delays with appeals aren't going very far with me this morning.
And I can
appreciate that. The prudent course would be, you know what, let's just have the evidentiary hearing and I'll decide it on the merits instead of dancing around and coming up with reasons why allegations that the county, you know, really wasn't working very hard to pursue this relative placement, despite clear law requiring it to do so. I mean, just there's a better way to handle these cases. And not seeing it here, so I'm not very sympathetic to arguments about the appeal process taking up time. I'm very sympathetic to the child, but I'm not going to blame a relative who has a legal right to be considered as placement from bringing this appeal.
To address some of the points that have been brought up by the court, the allegations by the appellant in his affidavits supporting the motion do also include quite a bit of information about contact that the county had with the appellant throughout the entire process. And so while there may not have been a visit to the home, there was a home study done. There was foster care licensing. There were professionals that were in the home. That information was
Council,
shared.
Counsel, could you clarify for us the home study and the foster care licensing? Did the county arrange that or did appellant arrange that on his own?
I believe that the appellant arranged for that on his own, and he did so very early on in the process after he was notified by the county of the placement through the relative search process. So he was never excluded by Chippewa County from the process. He was very much included right from the start with the notification letters. There were many emails. There were some phone calls between the parties. Mr. Renstrom did appear at hearings throughout the case. And so the county knew quite a bit about Mr. Renstrom when they were making their best interest determination in the March 2023 letter. And so when we're looking at some of the specific allegations that Mr. Renstrom makes about not getting a response from the social worker about the child's clothing size, so there were just a few very specific allegations, but when you look at that and you consider all of the contact that the county had to have with Mr. Renstrom to set up all the visitations, they were having a lot of contact. Perhaps there was an email or a phone call that didn't get a response, but when it came down to it, they were having a significant amount of contact. Unlike the MLS case that we've talked about, Mr. Renstrom was not iced out of the process.
Wait, what about the fact, just on unreasonableness, what about the fact that it sounds like it's undisputed that there never was a 260C.221 subdivision 5B determination by the district court that Mr. Renstrom was not to be considered, or the parent's request was consistent with the best interest of the child, and that letter seems to have driven a lot of what happened throughout the case. And it sounds like, according to your counterpart, the mother also expressed a preference against placement for the foster parents, but somehow that never counted against them. And so why isn't just that issue in and of itself not enough to find that there's prima facie for unreasonableness here?
Sure. The county and the court there was never a rule out. There was never a request by the county to have him ruled out. It's interesting in that March 2023 letter where the county says, had we known about it, maybe we would have handled the situation differently, but they didn't. They treated him like any other relative placement option from the very start of the case, including with facilitating visits, getting all of those scheduled. He was included in a lot of the correspondence and making decisions and being present at court. So he wasn't, from a technical perspective, ever ruled out, nor was he from a practical perspective and in the county's handling this, ruled out.
But in the order, I see your time.
Go ahead,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead,
I was just going to say, I mean, you know, paragraph 11 of the conclusions of law in the district court's order is all about the letter filed by the birth mother sent to the agency. And that's the paragraph that immediately precedes the conclusion that the Renstroms have an established prima facie. So, I mean, it seems like the letter carried the same weight and effect that a rule out would have had it been issued under the statute. And do you disagree?
I do disagree with that, Your Honor. I think the court's real analysis can be found in the memorandum of law. There's more context in the actual 1 through 12, but the memorandum was where the judge dives into what did the appellants actually allege as being unreasonable and have they met their burden? And the judge tells a little bit more of the story and the context in 1 through 11, 1 through 12.
Thank you, Ms. Clausen. Counsel for the appellant, you'll have the last word, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to clarify for the record that my client only met the social worker, met the social worker two times. He went to the TPR trial that was held in person. He appeared and the social worker introduced herself and walked away. That was the end of their contact. And then after the best interest decision letter was written, she supervised one of his visits because the visitation agency was not involved to supervise that. After that, she no longer responded to my client about visitation, but simply ran it through the visitation center, which then my client worked through there. And essentially we had to go to court to complain about the foster parents repeatedly canceling visitation, ask for the court's intervention to get the social worker to get involved to help facilitate that visitation. So there definitely is a record of the social worker not having that cooperative contact that would be required with my client. I also wanted to point out that the arguments the foster parent's attorney was just making have to do with how much contact he had with the agency. That would be a trial issue. The guardian's attorney made that point too about whether she returned every phone call or not. His argument for prima facie points is that he didn't get return calls. He didn't get cooperation. They didn't work with him like the statute requires. I also want to point out that the argument was made that the district court focused on points because my client brought them up in the affidavit. But what the guardian ad litem's attorney missed is that the district court didn't take my client's information as true. He made his defenses. Yes, he spent time talking about those points because he had to make his defenses. And ultimately, they should have been accepted as true and ended up in the district court findings as something the district court had to take as true. Instead, the district court referenced what my client was responding to and clearly took that as true instead of the other way around as is required. Let's see. The other points that are being made, I also believe, are trial issues. And I really appreciated what Judge Larkin said about the fact that the court should have just given the evidentiary hearing. And yes, obviously, whether or not my client would have survived that is a separate question. And that's what I think that the district court findings focus on, is whether or not my client would have survived that hearing. But that's the wrong legal standard. The court should have been talking about whether he deserved to get that hearing, not jumping to the conclusions of what would happen if that hearing happened and CCFS presented their arguments in their letters. I also want to make the point that the post-adoption contact being considered as such a relevant point by the district court, I also think is a problem because obviously that's a hypothetical. And the foster parent who has the child didn't know the foster parents that have the older three children beforehand. And the agency suggested that she facilitate that relationship. And it's another way that the agency was unreasonable in regards to my client, because they also should have encouraged my client to have that same relationship with that foster parent so that there could ultimately be that same potential for visitation. Plus, he's the safe, uncle to those children. So that relative contact could have been a bonus for those children's lives. And instead, that's become a major focus as to why he shouldn't get placement. And I believe that's really off point. I also want to make sure this court knows that my client was in the process in the prior Kandi Ohi case of getting licensed. And he and the county worker is now, the county worker that he was contacting about his licensing process is now the guardian ad litem assigned to this case. And that county worker at the time failed to tell the Kandi Ohi court that he was in the process behind the scenes of getting licensed. Instead, as we know, the agency went forward with asking the court to rule him out. And so now we have that same guardian ad litem, Ms. Barber, on this case. And of course,
is any of that in the record? I mean, this seems like a lot of extra record materials that are coming in here.
Your Honor, I believe it's in the record, but I'm happy to withdraw it because I think that we've made plenty of arguments this morning.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Spears. Thank you, Ms. Clausen. Thank you, Ms. Hatsala. We will issue our decision in the statutory time frame. The matter is submitted.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
You're welcome.